Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. In our first class, we looked at some examples from the Old Testament that demonstrated that God is in control and that He will fulfill His promises. God had told the children of Israel that if they disobeyed Him and worshiped other gods, that they would be scattered throughout the nations. We read the following in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 64 to 65. That's Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 64 to 65. And Yahweh shall scatter thee among all people, from the one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But Yahweh shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind. We also have God telling the prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, that there would be a scattering. The facts of history bear out the truthfulness of God's word. The Jews have been scattered all over the earth, and they have been persecuted, and they have become a proverb and a byword among all nations, as Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 37 states. However, the same God that caused them to be scattered says in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 3. That's Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 3. For lo, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah, saith the Lord. And I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it. Well, in order to see the magnitude of the regathering of Israel in the light of prophecy, we will retrace briefly the nation's past dispersions and regatherings. The first dispersion began in the year 721 BCE, which you see on your handout, when Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, besieged Samaria and took the 10 northern tribes into captivity. We read in 2 Kings chapter 17, beginning at verse 18. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of His sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only. By the way, Hezekiah was the king of Judah. Then verse 20. And Yahweh rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of spoilers until He had cast them out of His sight, until the Lord removed Israel out of His sight, verse 23, as He had said by all His servants, the prophets. So was Israel carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. Well, approximately 120 years later, Judah and Benjamin were led into the Babylonian captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. Then after the 70-year captivity in Babylon, Cyrus authorized the return of the captives to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Ezra the scribe. Now, I commented on Cyrus's role on this in a previous class on Daniel a couple of years ago, and I read the following verse from Isaiah chapter 44, verse 28, where it states, That saith of Cyrus, He is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, Thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. That God's hand was on Cyrus is very evident from incidents in his life. Information from one source said his own grandfather ordered his death as soon as he was born. But the man assigned to slay the child could not find it in his heart to do it. Cyrus was spared by what may be called the divine intervention of God, and he lived to fulfill all that had been prophesied about him by Isaiah. In a time when kings were savage and cruel, Cyrus was an enlightened and a benevolent ruler. A year after he had captured the city of Babylon, he issued an edict which allowed all Hebrews to return to their homeland if they desired to do it. He supplied them with food, with goods, and with the money necessary to rebuild the temple that had been destroyed by the Babylonians. After 70 years in Babylon, many Hebrews, now called Jews, and they were named after Judea, that's why they're called Jews, they were comfortable in this new land, and they refused to leave. In 536 B.C., again on the handout, in 536 B.C., less than 50,000 returned to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, the grandson of King Jehoiakim. The foundation of the new temple was laid the following year, but construction stopped when the workmen came under attack by the Samaritans, and it was finally completed in 515 B.C. under the direction of Haggai. 6 centuries later, the Romans, under Titus, destroyed Jerusalem and the temple that was enlarged to its original splendor by Herod the Great, and this dispersion in A.D. 70 would be worldwide. All of Herod's ambitious construction projects, the crowning glory of Jerusalem was the tabernacle of the temple. Josephus, who was a Jew born in this land of Israel, describes this pure white building as like a snow-capped mountain. He called it a snow-capped mountain. When Jesus prophesied the destruction of this magnificent structure, Herod the Great had already been dead for 37 years. The finishing touches on some of it had not yet been completed, and work would continue for another 30 years. A few days before he was crucified, Jesus was in the temple with his disciples. Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 to 2. Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 to 2. States the following. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. While Luke quotes Jesus warning the people of what will happen in Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21, verses 20 and 24, where he states, And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, some say compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then skipping to verse 24, And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Well, in the spring of A.D. 70, Titus surrounded Jerusalem with his army of about 80,000 men. Now, the siege of Jerusalem lasted until about July, with bloody fighting, sickness, and starvation. Josephus, who had been captured early in the war by the Romans, he was an eyewitness to the events, to the end. Titus had ordered that the sanctuary of the temple be spared, but one of his soldiers threw a blazing torch through the golden window that opened into the rooms next to the Holy of Holies. These rooms, which were paneled with wood and contained the jars of holy oil, they burst into flames. And Titus ordered the fire extinguished, but his men, they were bent on seizing as many of the valuable objects as possible, and they ignored his order. Now the holy place went up in flames. Later, Titus commanded that the whole city, including the temple, be razed to the ground. All he spared was Herod's towers, which were necessary to garrison his troops. The second temple was destroyed on the ninth day of the month of Ab, A-B, Hebrew. Josephus remarks in wonder at the timing of this destruction, for it was on exactly the same day of the same month as the destruction of the first temple built by Solomon approximately 700 years earlier, as described by Josephus in the Wars of the Jews on the history of the destruction of Jerusalem, Book 6, Chapter 4, Paragraph 8, which reads, and I quote, "Now, although anyone would justly lament the destruction of such a work as this was, since it was the most admirable of all the works that we have seen or heard of, both for its curious structure and its magnitude, and also for the vast wealth bestowed upon it, as well as for the glorious reputation it had for its holiness, yet might such a one comfort himself with this thought, that it was fate, this wasn't fate, that it was fate that decreed it so to be, which is inevitable, both as to living creatures and as to works and places also. However, one cannot but wonder at the accuracy of this period thereto relating, for the same month and day were now observed, as I said before, wherein the house was burnt formerly by the Babylonians. Now the number of years that passed from its first foundation, which was laid by King Solomon, till this its destruction, which happened in the second year of the reign of Vespasian, are collected to be 1,130, besides 7 months and 15 days. And from the second building of it, which was done by Haggai, in the second year of Cyrus the king, till its destruction under Vespasian, there were 639 years and 45 days, unquote. Well, the simple probability of these two events happening on exactly the same day does not reflect the improbability of these events, separated by almost 7 centuries, happening on the same day. The same day. This is against all odds. It's against all odds. Here again, I believe God is demonstrating His complete and total control over the destiny of mankind and the events of history. The prophecy made by Jesus 37 years before had also been fulfilled. One Roman centurion was heard to say that there was not one stone left upon another, and that there was no sign that the place had ever been inhabited. This dispersion after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 extended over 19 centuries until the 1917 Balfour Declaration was endorsed by the League of Nations in 1922 and authorized the return of Jews to their ancient homeland. Well, after being forcibly exiled from their land, the people never ceased to pray and to hope for their return to the land, and for the restoration in it of their political freedom. Impelled by this historic and traditional attachment, Jews strove in every successive generation to reestablish themselves in their ancient homeland. In recent decades, they returned in their masses. There were pioneers, there were defiant returnees, there were defenders. They made deserts bloom. They revived the Hebrew language. They built villages and towns. And they created a thriving community controlling its own economy and culture. And they were loving peace, but they knew how to defend itself and bring the blessings of progress to all the country's inhabitants. and aspiring towards independent nationhood. Well, in the year 1897, which is the Jewish year 56-57, at the summons of the spiritual fathers of the Jewish state, such as Theodor Herzl, the First Zionist Congress convened, and Theodor proclaimed the right of the Jewish people to national rebirth in its own country, their own country. This right was recognized in the Balfour Declaration on the 2nd of November, 1917, and it reaffirmed in the mandate of the League of Nations, which in particular gave international sanction to the historic connection between the Jewish people and Eretz Israel, which means the land of Israel, and to the right of the Jewish people to rebuild in its national homeland. Well, survivors of the Nazi Holocaust in Europe, as well as the Jews from other parts of the world, would migrate to Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, undaunted by difficulties, restrictions, and dangers. Many of us here witnessed the statehood of modern Israel and the return of exiles from over 100 countries in the face of insurmountable odds. On May 14, 1948, the British flag was hauled down from the High Commissioner's residence in Jerusalem, and the violent mandate period was over at precisely 4:20 p.m. in the Tel Aviv Museum. Mr. David Ben-Gurion read the historic Declaration of Independence and then announced, "I declare this meeting is adjourned. The State of Israel is established." Now, I have that declaration and the establishment of the State of Israel in a paper that was in a recent paper that I read. I'm going to just read the first few sentences from this, and then I'm going to post it later on in the day back on the wall back there for anybody that wants to read it. But this is what it said, and it's signed by David Ben-Gurion and the 37 other founders of the State of Israel. It says, "The land of Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. Here their spiritual, religious, and political identity was shaped. Here they first attained to statehood, created values of national and universal significance, and gave to the world the eternal book of books. After being forcibly exiled from their land, the people kept faith with it throughout their dispersion, and never ceased to pray and hope for their return to it and for the restoration in it of their political freedom. Impelled by this historic and traditional attachment, Jews strove in every successive generation to reestablish themselves in their ancient homeland. In recent decades, they returned in their masses." I'll hang this on the backboard after classes today, and anybody that's interested can read it. Well, Brother John Thomas, from his reading and understanding from Scripture, wrote a Bible prophecy, and this led to his making various detailed predictions about the reestablishment of the national homeland for the Jews in Israel and the role that Great Britain would play in its statehood. In his book, Elpis Israel, or The Hope of Israel, from 1848, chapter 17, The Resurrection of Israel, the Second Exodus, the Millennium, the End, Brother Thomas wrote the following, based on his understanding of what the Bible said about the return of Jews to the land of Palestine, and I quote, "There is then a partial and a primary restoration of Jews before the manifestation, which is to serve as the nucleus or the basis of future operations in the restoration of the rest of the tribes after he has appeared in the kingdom. the pre-eventual colonization of Palestine will be on a purely political principles, and the Jewish colonists will return in unbelief of the Messiahship of Jesus and of the truth as it is in Him. They will immigrate thither as agriculturists and traders in the hope of ultimately establishing their commonwealth, but more immediately of getting rich in silver and gold by commerce with India, and in cattle and goods by their industry at home under the efficient protection of the British power. We saw that come to be. Further, he goes on saying the following, "But to what part of the world shall we look for a power whose interests will make it willing, as it is able, to plant the ensign of civilization upon the mountains of Israel?" The reader will doubtless anticipate my reply from what has gone before. I know not whether the men who at present contrive the foreign policy of Britain entertain the idea of assuming the sovereignty of the Holy Land and of promoting its colonization by the Jews. Their present intentions, however, are of no importance one way or the other, because they will be compelled by events soon to happen to do what, under existing circumstances, heaven and earth combined could not move them to attempt. The present decisions of statesmen are destitute of stability. The finger of God has indicated a course to be pursued by Britain, which cannot be evaded, and which her counselors will not only be willing, but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them." Unquote. Isn't that right on to what we've seen happen? The Balfour Declaration of 1917 and the British Mandate of 1922 established Britain as the political force in charge of Palestine. After British rule, the secular state of Israel was established in 1948. Now we all should realize that God rules in the kingdom of men. For we read in Daniel chapter 4, verse 17, "To the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men." Just have to think about what's going on in our country right now with the running for the presidential election. God is in control and sets up in power who He wants in power. Moreover, as I was saying, God sets in place the person He wants for obtaining His purpose, just as we saw in class 1 with Gideon. Despite pressure from the U.S. State Department not to recognize Israel, lest America offend Arab oil-producing nations, President Harry S. Truman was the first to recognize the State of Israel on May 14, 1948. Years after the State of Israel was founded, David Ben-Gurion met with President Truman, and Ben-Gurion noted the following, and I quote, I told him his courageous decision to recognize our new state so quickly and steadfast support since then had given him an immortal place in Jewish history. As I said that, tears suddenly came to his eyes, and his eyes were still wet when he bade me goodbye. Later, a correspondent came up to me to ask, "Why was President Truman in tears when he left you?" Unquote. Well, history records that Harry Truman was a man of utmost integrity and was highly principled. He was the 33rd President of the United States of America. His word was his bond. And more than once he stated, he just tells the truth. He was raised in a Bible-believing Zionist home, and Truman helped various Jewish family immigrants to come to America to escape the Holocaust. When the hour came for Yahweh to breathe life into a Zionist state that had lain dead for nearly 2,000 years, the Almighty had a man in the White House courageous enough to ignore the political experts around him and to recognize the state of Israel. In spite of the fact that the new nation of Israel was almost totally defenseless and unprepared to withstand a savage jihad or a holy war of extermination launched by six neighboring Arab states, the Jewish occupants of their ancient homeland stood upon their feet an exceeding great army, and they astounded the world by their victory, although they were outnumbered 80-1. 80-1. During the initial stages of this historic Israel War of Independence, we find that the military position of the Jewish nation was not prepared to fight a war against all its neighbors. On May 15, 1948, Egyptian fighter bombers strafed and bombed Tel Aviv, while armored units from Egypt, Jordan, Syria, supported by troops from Iraq, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, they poured across the borders. And as the days grew into weeks, the infant state began to flex its muscles. From a Piper Cub aircraft, Israel's Air Force came into being. An ancient discarded icebreaker was salvaged off the sandbanks of Haifa and became Israel's Navy, which engaged the Egyptians off Tel Aviv. The Haganah and the Ergun, they united to become the Israeli Defense Forces, or the IDF, which is what they're called today, the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF. According to an article in the 2011 Third Quarter Sanctuary Keeper on the website www.jewishvirtuallibrary, which is the second website on the back of the handout, according to that website, we find this information. They did not have a single cannon or tank. Its air force consisted of 9 obsolete planes. The Haganah, which was the army, had 60,000 trained fighters, of which only 18,900 were fully mobilized, armed, and prepared for war. And there are different numbers provided on different websites. The Israeli chief of operations told his leader, Ben-Gurion, that Israel, at best, had only a 50-50 chance of success. Yet, against all odds, Israel survived. Why was that? Why was that? There were many notable and courageous battles fought by this fledgling nation. And this following information was also obtained from the website, the third one that's in the handout, and also spelled out in the Sanctuary Keeper. The following information was obtained from that website. The Battle of Nirim. 45 defenders in Nirim and 30 defenders in Kfar Darum withstood major attacks by the Egyptians on May 15th. The Battle of Yad Mordecai, May 19th to the 24th, about 110 poorly armed defenders, reinforced at different times by an Israeli platoon and 2 squads, held off a major concerted Egyptian attack for 5 days with 2 battalions, tanks, artilleries, and air attacks. And then the kibbutz finally fell on May 24th. The first battle of Negba, about 140 defenders hold off 1,000 Egyptians who attacked with tanks, infantry, and armored cars. The second battle of Negba, again a small group of defenders withstood a massive Egyptian attack. Now this was considered a turning point in the battle against the Egyptians in the second period of fighting during July 9th to 18th, 1948. Now, Now I want to take you back. I want to take you back to a battle that was fought by the British against the Turkish Empire during World War I. World War I. You recall from our first class the example of Jonathan and his armor bearer at Michmash, overcoming 20 or more Philistines against all odds. I now want to present a parallel story that occurred at Michmash on February 18, 1918. Turkey, at that time, decided to join Germany against England during World War I, and it would spell the end of the Ottoman Empire. The Turks had ruled Palestine for over 400 years. 400 years. In September 1917, General Allenby arrived in Cairo. He was the British general. By December, Jerusalem was in British hands, and General Allenby approached the Jaffa Gate and walked. He walked, instead of riding his horse, into Jerusalem. He walked on foot, and he stated, "I come not as a conqueror, but as a pilgrim." On February 18, 1918, 2 months since the British took Jerusalem, they expected the Turks to try a counteroffensive to retake Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem would only be safe if all of Palestine was liberated. A brigade of English troops was sent to catch the Turkish garrison at Michmash. When the brigade arrived at Michmash, they didn't think the Turks would expect an attack because they arrived undetected. The commanding officer wanted a full frontal assault the next day, but it would be very costly in lives lost. That evening, Brigadier Major Vivian Gilbert took 2 men with him to scout out the Turkish camp on a cliff above the valley. He saw that the cliff created a formidable fortress. Any attempt to climb the walls would almost be certain suicide. Even so, if there was a way to climb the cliffs, it would catch the Turks by total surprise. Total surprise. He saw that the Turkish garrison was perhaps several thousand strong. A surprise attack, climbing the walls, would be impossible unless it was from the canyon itself. Moreover, a surprise attack from the cliff wouldn't allow an attack from the canyon itself and the cavalry. Back in those days, they had horses. They were on the cavalry. A cavalry could charge from the plain unnoticed. Well, when Major Gilbert returned to camp that night, he thought he had read about Michmash before. Finally, it struck him when he opened his Bible to Samuel, and he read about Jonathan and his armor bearer against the Philistines in 1 Samuel chapter 14. He realized that the British were camped in the same spot as Israel had been over 3,000 years earlier. He showed his commanding officer the Bible passage, and that he had found the path that Jonathan had used, and that they could use it to attack the Turks. Well, the Turks would never expect an attack from the cliffs. The general agreed and told Major Gilbert to proceed. A Bible account held the key to a 20th century battle plan. Gilbert prayed. He prayed that God would repeat history. The Turkish army was asleep, unaware of the British presence, and a 3,000-year-old Bible account was about to be repeated. The British climbed the cliff, they slit the throats of lookouts, and they captured about 20 men that were sitting around the campfire. Then they blew shofars, they set off bombs, and the British cavalry rode in from the canyon. The Turks thought that English General Allenby brought his entire army of 100,000 troops to attack them. So they began to run, and they started fighting against each other. So after 3,000 years, the British successfully copied the tactics of Jonathan and Saul. Now isn't that against all odds? Against all odds? Now let's turn to Haggai, chapter 2. Haggai, chapter 2. And we want to read verses 10 to 21. Haggai chapter 2, verses 10, we'll go to 22. In the 24th day of the 9th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Ask now the priest concerning the law, saying, If one bear holy flesh, in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread, or pottage, or wine, or oil, or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, No. Then said Haggai, If one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, It shall be unclean. Then answered Haggai and said, So is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord, saith Yahweh. And so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. And now I pray you, consider from this day and upward, from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord, since those days were, when one came to an heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the press vat for to draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20. I smote you with blasting and with mildew and with hail and all the labors of your hands. Yet ye turn not to me, saith the Lord, saith Yahweh. Consider now, from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, from the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree hath not brought forth. From this day will I bless you. And again, the word of the Lord came unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month, 24th day of the month, saying, Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heaven, and I will overthrow the chariots, and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. Well, according to one source, the 24th day of the 9th month in the Hebrew calendar was December 9th, 1917. That's December 9th, 1917. The very day that the mayor of Jerusalem handed the keys of the city to the British army. If this date was, in fact, the 24th day of the 9th month, was that not against all odds? God makes history, and He makes the future, too. Against all odds, we find the Hebrew language, which was a dead ancient language for nearly 2,000 years, brought back to life. There is a book. This book here, entitled The Tongue of the Prophets, by Robert St. John, that I purchased from our bookstore here a few years ago. I saw two copies in our bookstore this year at the Bible school. I saw one copy last night in the Bible school bookstore. This book is the fascinating biography of Eliezer ben Yehuda, the father of modern Hebrew. It is the story of a faithful fanatic who had two great love affairs. Ben Yehuda had tuberculosis most of his life. His first wife died from tuberculosis. He married her sister, a younger sister. So he had two loves in his life. He was always on the verge of death from tuberculosis. He went to prison for his beliefs. Some of his enemies were his best friends. Yet he fathered 11 children. 11 children. And he gathered the material for a 16-volume dictionary unlike any other philological work ever conceived. He authored plays, a geography, and two of the most urgent appeals ever addressed to his own people. And he died while working on the word for soul. In the book, Eliezer ben Yehuda, self-styled son of Judea, it was explained that Hebrew began to die out as a commonly spoken language at the time of the Maccabees, almost 200 years before the start of the Christian era. In one period, Greek was the common language of many Jews. Later, as Jews settled in various parts of the world, they began to use the tongue of the countries in which they found themselves. In Germany, in the Middle Ages, the Jews spoke the language of those around them, and that was medieval German. Only they wrote in Hebraic characters. When vast numbers of them were forced to leave Germany, and they settled in Poland and Russia, they took medieval German with them as their language. But gradually their talk became unintelligible to a German, even to a German Jew, for several reasons. Back in Germany, medieval German underwent many changes until modern German finally developed. But in their ghettos in the East, the Jews were isolated from such language and such changes. Also, they grafted many Hebrew words to their language, and then they often distorted words on purpose in order to be able to say things among themselves without their non-Jewish neighbors being able to understand. Thus, Yiddish was born. The same thing happened with medieval Spanish, which came to be known as Ladino. I wish I would have taken Spanish in high school. Unfortunately, I had 2 years of Latin, the dead language. Ben Yehuda said, "I read somewhere that we Jews speak 70 different languages, yet none of us speaks our own language. Today, the languages of the ghetto cling to us like leprosy. We can never aspire to be free men as long as we use those ghetto dialects." Unquote. Eliezer had a theory that if the Jews were ever to be unified, they must be given a common language again. He dedicated his life to reviving the Hebrew spoken language. And there was much opposition to this scheme for reviving the language. There were those who thought that an attempt to establish a Jewish state and revive the language would arouse dormant anti-Semitics to new excesses of violence. Eliezer ben Yehuda wrote numerous newspaper articles with amplification of his ideas. In one article answering the criticism that he was being blind to reality because the Turks would never allow the Jews any rights in Palestine, he wrote the following: "There are times in the history of a nation when it is not the clever ones who are important, but those who have a vision to see through the dark curtain of actuality." Well, Eliezer ben Yehuda was born in 1858 and he died in 1922. He was born Eliezer Perlman in a small cottage on the side street in the Jewish quarter of Lutsk, Russia. He completed 5 volumes of books on the Hebrew language. Philologists and language scholars in England, Germany, the United States, France, and Palestine, and among them some of Ben Yehuda's Dominican friends, worked with his former secretary, Moshe Nissim, to complete the 6th and 7th volumes. By 1951, 13 volumes averaging 600 pages each had been put into print, and only 2 letters of the Hebrew alphabet remained. Shin, S-H-I-N, the equivalent of the sh sound in English, and Tav, T-A-V, the final letter. It was estimated that these 2 letters would require 3 more volumes, making 16 in all. After the State of Israel came into existence, the completion of the dictionary became a state project. The last word on which Ben Yehuda himself had done any work was nephesh, the word for soul. He left, however, most of the material required for 11 posthumous volumes. Once, long before the Balfour Declaration was issued, Ben Yehuda had said to his wife, and I quote, "Old men talk about what is going to happen after their death. Such matters have never interested me. I only pray that I shall live long enough to see the rebirth of Israel as a nation and the use of our own language on our own soil," unquote. Well, he did not live long enough to witness the rebirth of Israel. In 1922, there was no Jewish state. Israel only existed in dreams. The Jews of Palestine would have to wait another quarter century to see the flag which had been given. That flag had been given to Eliezer Ben Yehuda in New York, fly over Jerusalem as a symbol of the existence of a free and an independent Israel. But he did live to see the day when a census was taken in Palestine and virtually every Jew in the country put down on his form under mother tongue the word Hebrew. He did live to see the language which he had had such a major part in reviving being used in all the schools without further debate. When Ben Yehuda started work on his dream, Hebrew was only a liturgical medium, as dead as ancient Latin. It had not even breathed for 2,000 years. By the time he made his last trip up to the Mount of Olives, where he was buried, a new and vibrant Hebrew was being spoken by a new and vibrant race of Jews. During the 41 years he had struggled to bring this about, he had often been called a fanatic. However, the dead language was revived because he persevered. Remember that word that was used last night by Brother Ernie when he started out. It wasn't persevere. What was it, Ernie? He prevailed in spite of his serious health issues. Is this not against all odds? Well, in our last class today, Lord willing, we're going to review events and the wars that Israel survived and fought since being reborn as a nation in 1948.